This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Right when you said record, I had to burp.
Your burp should be the cold open. It could just be burp. Welcome to She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time. Today, we're going to talk about Minet De Silva, a pioneering figure of architecture in Sri Lanka. I'm Nurjiri Rivas, reading about genetically engineered mosquitoes that will be released in my county in Houston, Texas.
Hello, I'm Jessica Rogers, freaked out about those engineered mosquitoes in Washington, D.C.
Hey there, I'm Lizzie Rahr, not worrying about mosquitoes in San Francisco.
Yeah, okay, whatever. You got smoke.
So, yes.
And fog.
Oh, wow.
Like always, our quick disclaimer. The three of us are not historians, nor are we experts on this subject. We are just sharing stories about the information that we find about each woman. If we get our facts a little mixed up, please forgive us, leave us a comment, and we will all continue learning.
Today, I'm going to take you on a journey east, all the way to the island of Sri Lanka.
Okay.
The time was February 1st, 1918. The place, Kandy, Ceylon. Today, the island is no longer Ceylon. It's Sri Lanka.
When they were a British colony, they were called Ceylon. But they achieved independence, got a name change, rebranded, you know?
Yes. And this was very important because, like you said, when she was born, the island was a British colony. Her dad, George De Silva, was a known journalist, lawyer, and politician. In his lifetime, he was president of the Ceylon National Congress and also served as Minister of Health. Her mom, Agnes Snell, was an activist who pioneered women-related issues in her country, such as suffrage. And in her free time, she designed their family home.
That's so fun.
Yeah, you know. Both of Minet's parents worked towards Sri Lankan independence from British rule and progressive causes, such as women's rights. And they were shakers and bakers. Important figures like Gandhi and Indian Prime Minister Nehru visited and stayed in Minet's family home. There's a story that one time a house guest complained about the beds, and Minette said, "Well, if they're good enough for Gandhi, they are good enough for you."
Bam.
Okay, Minette. She's got some sass, and I approve. Also, casual Gandhi name drop.
Minette was the baby of the family. She and I have that in common. Young Minette became friends with young Indira Gandhi, who was Nehru's daughter. They were both about the same age. Later in life, Indira became Prime Minister of India, and to this day, she's the only female Prime Minister India has ever had.
Whoa. Minette was hanging with some big players.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Minette's sister, Anil da Silva, was an art critic, political activist, and historian. Her brother, Frederick da Silva, was a lawyer and politician who served as mayor of Kandy, a member of the parliament, and Sri Lanka's ambassador to France. Frederick married Esme Nathaniels, who had spent a year at the Bauhaus.
This family is like success on success on success.
Yeah. They're a family of high achievers.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
When Minette was a child, she was educated at St. Mary's in Brighton, England, and returned to Ceylon when she was 11. Then, in 1939, at age 21, Minette announced to her family that she wanted to be an architect, and they were like, absolutely not.
Hey!
Yeah, like, what's wrong with becoming an architect?
Who knows? It was a whole thing. But eventually, she convinced her father to let her do it. Her father, the guy that was progressive, thought that architecture was a little too progressive for a lady. Ladies, her aunt was a doctor. Her mother and older sister were political activists. Her sister-in-law was a designer. Yet architecture is just crossing a line? I don't get it. What makes architecture so scandalous?
Yeah, I feel like we've come across this a lot when studying these women, that people seem to feel that women doctors and lawyers were necessary and they could understand why having women in those professions was important. But that apparently didn't apply to STEM industry professions, which is so bizarre. I think it was Louise Bethune who had that quote saying exactly that. She obviously supported women in the architecture profession, but she had that whole argument about the female gender didn't change how a person approaches a design project. And she differentiated it from doctors and lawyers and how it was important for women to be in those professions. And Concepcion from a few weeks ago, when she was certified, that article talked about how there were already women doctors and lawyers, but women hadn't broken into engineering thus far.
Yeah. We can also say that Mariana from season one, when we talked about landscape architecture, she was so progressive, but yet she didn't think landscape architecture was a profession for women. Do you guys remember that? The hypocrite.
I recall.
I remember you saying that.
Yep, because it's true.
Well, Minette went to study in Bombay, and there she worked as an apprentice for the firm Mistry and Bedwar. And she became friends with Perin Mistry and her brother Minu. Actually, Perin Mistry was an Indian architect and one of the first women to qualify as an architect in India.
Future episode alert.
Minette also took private classes at the Architectural Academy. And then some sources say that she enrolled at the Sir JJ School of Art. But others say that she didn't. Regardless of which school she went to, she was part of political and cultural circles. She rubbed elbows with Mulk Raj Anand, the writer of Today Classic, but then Modern Indo-English Literature. And she was also buddies with Ravi Shankar, famous Indian musician and composer. During this time, her sister was also in Bombay, and she, along with a group of people, including Mulk Raj Anand, founded MARC, a quarterly journal on modern art and culture. Minette was a contributing editor.
Cool.
Very cool.
She was all work, 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 work. In her spare time, which only Minette knows when that was, she went to a free Gandhi march and she got expelled from school.
Oh, dang. I guess she grew up with a bunch of activists, but why does that warrant expulsion?
Yeah, was this too rebellious?
I don't exactly know why. Sources say that it was for not writing an apology to the head of the school. But why would she need to apologize for that? Did she miss class? I don't know.
What? She was expelled for not apologizing?
Yeah, weird. But that didn't stop Minette. She just went to work for the architect and planner, Otto Königsberger, in his office in Bangalore, working on prefabricated housing for the Tata Steel City plan in Bihar.
Look at Minette. She didn't give a crap about being expelled. She just kept on keeping on.
Yep.
During that time, she met the head of the education committee in the UK. Who else is this lady going to meet?
But for real, though, like,
I want to see her shadow.
She got around.
And just meet. Like, yeah.
And not in the slutty way.
Yeah, so she met the head of the education committee in the UK, and he helped her get a spot to take an exam to enter the Architectural Association.
Ooh, the AA in London, you know, that famous alma mater of Zaha Hadid, Denise Scott Brown, and Jane Drew from episode 7, you know, just to name a few.
Yeah, no big deal. Minette working her connections. So I'm assuming she got in, right?
Of course she did.
Yeah.
And she graduated in 1948. Actually, she was the first Southeast Asian woman to become an associate member of the Royal Institute of British Architects.
Wait a minute. When did Jane graduate again?
1934.
So did they cross paths?
You're onto something, Jessica, because during her time in London, Minette met and became lifelong friends with Jane Drew and Maxwell.
Oh, Dame Jane and Maxie.
That's so cool. They were biffles.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember that Jane and Max were part of Siam?
Yeah, we do. Okay, so a quick refresher for the listeners, though. Siam, C-I-A-M. They were a group of international modern architects. It was revolutionary at that time and famous today. So was Minette a part of Siam too?
Yes. She went as a delegate of Sri Lanka and India. She was the very first Asian delegate of Siam, and she became close friends with a guy we've talked about before.
Not Corby Corb.
The one and only famous architect Le Corbusier.
Macaque.
Corbu gets around, no?
Yeah, they all do.
I mean,
she and Corb met up with each other and corresponded regularly until he died. There's some gossip that they were romantic, but there's no proof. I think Minette was too smart to get involved with a married man 30 years her senior. I think they were just friends. Maybe they flirted sometimes.
Well, we all know that Corbu and some of these other starchitects like to dip their toes where they didn't belong. And who knows? You know, long nights in the studio, coffee trips, site visits. Something could have happened with Minette and Corbu.
Let's hope not, though. I feel like I've heard some stories about Corbu and indiscretion. So, you know.
Yeah. But let's move on from that. Besides, Minette was very used to running in the same circles as famous artists. If I haven't mentioned enough famous people, let me name drop some more.
Okay.
Pablo Picasso, Henri Cartier-Bresson, Aldous Huxley, Laurence Olivier, all her friends.
Casual.
Whoa. I want to be her friend.
We thought Mariana knew people.
Yeah, nah. There's a couple of other people we knew that knew people, but she knows, like, more people on top of that.
Minette.
Like, Minette.
And from, like, all different
Like,
yes,
different places. It's not just architecture. It's like art, politics, you know.
Everybody.
Activists.
Everybody. You know what? Something I found interesting about her is that she never got married. And supposedly one time she told a friend that husbands were only good for carrying one's bags. Whatever that means.
Mina can carry her own bags.
In 1948, she spoke at the World Congress of Intellectuals in Defense of Peace. And you can see a little montage of this on YouTube. Actually, I'm going to post the link in the show notes. You have to see it. It looks like they gave her a standing ovation. It looks epic.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, I want to see this.
Mm-hmm. After she graduated, her family insisted that she had to go back home to the recently independent Sri Lanka and make her contributions, help the new country.
Oh, so now they see her value as an architect.
Yeah. Right? Go figure.
Now it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Back home in Kandy, Sri Lanka, she was inspired by the architect Ananda Kumaraswamy, who advocated for the preservation of the traditional arts and crafts, local craftsmen, and building methods and materials. That was super important to Minette, and it influenced her architectural style. She was also influenced by the modern architecture that was becoming popular at the time, and she also had education and perspectives from different countries. She was one of the first architects in Sri Lanka that incorporated what she learned from the West with Indian and Sri Lankan architecture. She didn't do just one or the other or a weird mix. She was very careful of creating architecture that made sense in Sri Lanka. Her style was part of what is known today as tropical regionalism.
That's so interesting and nice that she took what she learned but didn't try to like plop it into a totally different culture and climate.
Yeah, that's so cool. And it's interesting to think of, like, recreating an aesthetic for essentially a new country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And think about it. The country had just achieved independence. So moving forward, their cultural identity through architecture was extremely important. They had to form something that was their own and not just a veneer of colonialism or completely foreign.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's really cool that she got to be part of it.
Dope. So dope.
She spoke about her desire to create relationships between modern and traditional architecture. And I loosely quote because I only found this quote in Spanish, so I'm forced to translate the translation, but I'll give it my quote voice anyway. The necessities of our community and society need to find a regional expression in urban planning, housing, and public buildings. What happens often is that we copy closed Occidental models that do not fit our region, or we try to adapt it to regional architecture in ways that do not fit.
This is awesome. An issue that we've talked about as we researched these international ladies was that we wanted to find women from these international cities that created authentic designs that catered to their respective countries. This is great, Nirjiti. Like, she focused her designs to reflect the culture of her country. Okay, so Nirjiti, what are some other examples of her work?
Her first building was the Karunaratne House in Kandy from 1949 to 1951, commissioned by friends of her parents. She designed a split-level house for a site on a hill. It was considered an experiment of regional modern architecture, using modern materials like reinforced concrete, glass blocks, modern ideas of the open plan, movable walls, interior gardens, as well as local materials such as ceramics and teak wood. This building was the first of its kind. It was also the first building designed by a woman in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
Woe on woe.
The project was published in Marg magazine and highly praised. So you think she was a celebrity with her innovative architecture. But by now, we know better. She was the only woman architect in Sri Lanka. And as you can imagine, that caused her a lot of problems.
Unwanted advances?
Well, Lizzie,
Articles mention how she was a very pretty woman and men used to follow her around, so I would not be surprised if there were unwanted advances in her life.
Okay, that's fair. So what about these problems, though? Did she wear pants? Was that the problem? Was she getting paid the same as the men?
Good question. In a lot of pictures I saw of her, she was wearing dresses. Maybe that was the real issue. She definitely was not getting paid the same as men. She was a woman. She worked on her own. She had her own firm. Contractors, the government, and clients, all men, didn't trust her because she was new and because she was a woman. I quote from Minette, "I was dismissed because I am a woman. I was never taken seriously for my work." Because she did her job and stood her ground, people started calling her a difficult woman.
Sounds like the earlier version of a nasty woman.
Minette paid no mind to the haters. She kept doing her thing. She did a lot of work in the decade of the 50s, such as the Peary's House in 1952, the Amarecinque House and Fernando House in 1954, Aluares Sports Pavilion Police Park, 1955, and the Kumaraswamy Homes in 1960. I guess the last one is not part of the 50s, but let's throw it in there.
Nice.
Cool.
As part of Minette's approach to design, first, she talked for a long time with future householders. Basically, she surveyed how they lived. And then she used that research to inform her designs.
This reminds me of a few women that we've mentioned before. I'm thinking a little bit like our Caryatid from season one, Elizabeth Roberts, and even like Julia Morgan, you know, like the people's architect.
Yeah. And I also thought about Hans Schroeder from earlier this season and how she would design adaptable spaces for people based on the needs they had to make the space more efficient.
Yeah.
Actually, the Fernando House that I mentioned before, the original owner was still living there at least in 2018. And she talked about how Minette was very smart and sensitive to cost and looked for ways to cut expenses. And that she was very cooperative.
That's so great. It feels amazing when you design a space that the client is super happy with, especially a residence. I love when I get to hear that from a client.
Yeah. She was also interested in minimalist living, and she wrote an article in Cost-Effective Housing Studies. "We must reorient our ideas for living comfortably in congested towns like Colombo, where we no longer have expansive acres of garden and spacious, cool pillared halls."
That's great that she wanted to focus on smaller living spaces and saw the need for making them functional and cost-effective.
Yeah. And she tested those theories throughout all of her architecture. Her house designs were often raised pilotis, interior gardens, increasing cross ventilation and natural lighting through spaces. She made stairs as an...
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability... Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guidepost for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.